Heaney, what do we have today?
So today we're going to talk about NVIDIA's new 40 series graphics cards, Unreal Engine, Nanite, and Lumen, now working in virtual reality, Quest finally getting in VR recording options, Pico's announcement, which is teased for Thursday, and the revelation that original PlayStation VR games aren't playable on PlayStation VR 2. So yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah, big news. So let's talk about those new NVIDIA cards. It's been a while. I'm still on a 20 series card, Heaney. Why don't we talk about the prices that they picked and the advances that they're pitching in these new cards, Heaney?
Yeah, so this new RTX 40 series uses NVIDIA's new Ada Lovelace architecture, and it's quite a significant node process improvement here from Samsung's 8 nanometer down to TSMC's 4 nanometer. So even if NVIDIA hadn't have made a whole new architecture, there still would be significant performance benefits to be expected. But of course, there is also improvements in their architecture. So even the first card they're announcing here, the RTX 4080 12 gigabyte at $900, is more powerful than the previous flagship, the 3090 Ti. And when you go all the way up to the 4090, which is priced at $1,600, it is twice as powerful as that flagship. So NVIDIA is marketing this as a quantum leap in performance. And usually something like that would be a marketing exaggeration. But I think the specs that they've delivered here do seem to actually bear out on that claim. Obviously, we'll need to wait to see independent benchmarks, to see what this is like in real games and to see what the real result is. But this does look to be one of the most significant generational leaps in graphics cards ever.
Yeah, I noticed I was looking down their list of games compatible with the DLSS 3, and Flight Simulator was the only one that stood out to me as VR compatible. Are you excited? Are you going to be upgrading and checking out simulators with this card anytime soon?
So yeah, DLSS 3.0 is one of the new improvements of the Ada Lovelace architecture. And you'll know DLSS previously is a kind of neural upscaling technology that allows you to run games at, say, 1440p and have the card intelligently upscale it to 4K to look almost as good as native 4K. Many people would argue already just as good as 4K. 3.0 adds a new feature, which is actually, we actually already have in VR, the idea of reprojecting to create synthetic frames to not increase the resolution, but increase the frame rate. So Space Warp that we have on Meta systems, motion smoothing that Valve has in Steam VR and PSVR's doesn't have an official name, just reprojection, already does this, but NVIDIA now has better hardware level support in their graphics card and an SDK for even non-VR games to do it. I'd be really interested to compare something like motion smoothing or Space Warp with DLSS 3.0, but as far as I know, it wouldn't take into account the actual VR tracking like those technologies use.
Do you know what the power draw is on these devices? Adam's asking.
NVIDIA is claiming that it's the same power draw for the performance they're claiming. So when they say two times the performance of the 3090 Ti on the 4090, they are claiming that that's at the same power level. I think the trade-off here is they do look to be slightly larger. I haven't confirmed that. We've only just reported on this. They look to be physically larger than the previous generation of cards, but you wouldn't expect more power to be needed because, as I said, you're seeing a pretty significant increase in the technology from 8 nanometer to 4 nanometer.
Yeah, the nanometer jump there, Onikaze making the joke, doesn't quantum mean small? And I just keep thinking about how small we're talking. It's kind of ridiculous how small they're able to get now with the processes. I kind of missed that we were getting that small. And doesn't that introduces like errors in the transmission of these that they have to handle with the chip architecture? One thing I've been hearing for so many years is they're going to reach a fundamental limit to shrinking this. Are we reaching that in the size of these, Heaney?
Yeah, that's what a lot of the experts say, especially as, you know, in future, you'll get 3 nanometer, 2 nanometer, 1 nanometer. Eventually, it will run into physical limits, but it's not like at that point improvements stop. There'll just be other ways to go past it. The prediction that Moore's law will end has been made for many, many years now. It hasn't come to pass yet. And there are, from Intel to NVIDIA to AMD, there are a range of ideas of how do you keep bringing dramatic improvements in performance once you reach the physical node process limit. process notes.
Hello to Alyssa from Denver, Colorado. And yeah, please like the show down there, hit that like button. And it was really cool last week when we heard all the people sound off in our comments when they said what country they were tuning in from. We've got a lot of worldwide viewers. It's really cool to see that. So let us know what country you're tuning in from. Heaney, did you give the prices of these? I might have missed that if you mentioned them, but what are the prices on these again?
Yeah, like I said, the 4080 is available in a 12 gigabyte VRAM version is $900. The 16 gigabyte is $1,200, and the 4090 is just available in a single 24 gigabyte version for $1,600. So that is competitive against the previous cards. It's not like we're seeing some sort of dramatic price increase. The only question here will be about supply. Have we come out of the supply chain crisis enough that NVIDIA will not have a shortage of these? Obviously, with crypto currencies like Ethereum changing to proof of stake rather than proof of work, there's less demand for GPUs in crypto. So that may mean that there's a larger supply for gaming. Optimistically here, it could be a great time for PC gaming. We could see that kind of stagnation that's happened because of GPU card prices and availability becoming to an end soon. But who knows? We'll have to see what happens.
There's also the rise of the stable diffusion type locally generated images by AI. Like, I do wonder whether that could pop off in a really big way and cause demand for these new generation cards to go become problematic again. Wow, we really do have a global audience out there. Germany, Brazil, Canada, saw Cayman Islands mentioned, Nigeria, Israel, Iran, Poland, Denmark. It is amazing to see the global audience we have. I'm waiting for someone to tune in from Antarctica. That would be pretty neat to see if we get that far, because that's really the power of VR, is it collapses distance. Oh, wow. These are the benchmarks, Heaney?
These are NVIDIA's claimed relative performance benchmarks. I'm very Apple-like in that you don't get specific frame rates. You get their kind of relative performance. The bottom one here is using a new kind of software technology, so let's not include this. But if you look at these two top ones, they're claiming that the 4080s, the two variants of it, have pretty much almost twice the performance of the 3080 Ti. So that's a pretty significant increase, like we were saying. And I can bring up the other chart for the 4090, where they're claiming pretty much the same, that it has effectively double the performance of the 3090 Ti. Obviously, though, NVIDIA is going to pick the games that shows the card best. We're going to want to wait for real independent benchmarks to make any real conclusions, but it's looking promising based on the specs and what NVIDIA is showing.
Be ready to move on to Unreal Engine?
Yep, let's move on.
Yeah, so Unreal Engine's Nanite and Lumen systems now work in VR. We've been watching these tweets from Alex out there doing some really cool work showing these systems running in VR. Heaney, walk us through the significance, or at least the timeline here, of Unreal Engine 5 having this support.
Yeah, so Unreal Engine 5 has been out in a beta early access since last year. I think it was April this year that it fully launched. But its two headline features, Nanite and Lumen, didn't work with virtual reality. So if you were wanting to build a VR app with UE5, you really missed out on the main benefits of the engine. So it didn't even really make sense to go to UE5. You could probably have just been just as well off on the more stable UE4 with the existing tools you're used to. But now with 5.1, as that developer you spoke about demonstrated, the Lumen and Nanite work in VR. And Nanite is obviously the flagship feature of UE5, where in older engines, the artists would have to import reduced detailed versions of their assets and then build lower and lower quality versions of those assets. This is a system called level of detail. So the further you go away from an object in a game, the lower detail it gets. You'll have seen this all the time. When it's done badly, people call it pop-in. Obviously, there is texture pop-in, but there's also model pop-in, where you see lower detail versions. Nanite is a completely new approach to this, where the artist imports the full detail version of the asset, and the engine intelligently adapts the level of fidelity of the object as you get further away. So the result should look seamless and allow for objects that are incredibly high detail when you're close to them, but that don't ruin performance as you get further away from them. And to see that in VR is obviously going to be incredible for what people are able to build, both from the ease of developing applications to the end result. And then Lumen is the kind of real-time global illumination system that works alongside it, which you can see demonstrated if you Google or look on YouTube. It's very impressive tech, and to see it come to VR is very promising. We know that there are multiple PlayStation VR 2 games in development using Unreal Engine 5, so I will be very interested to see whether they use Lumen and Night.
For people who are just sort of new to the background of the studio, but Heaney built this in Unity, and Unity is kind of the most popular by numbers game engine, so it's used by the greatest number of developers. But on the other end of the spectrum, Unreal Engine tends to be the workhorse engine used by some of the biggest game studios out there for some of their biggest projects. And I remember, I think I was talking to some developers, and when we talk about a mobile system like Quest 2, you're talking one or two lights that you can use in like your game at all because of just how performance constrained. The amount of light sources you can have in a game really is connected to the visual fidelity you get out of the experience at the end of the day. And the game we had a little while back, we've got a graphics comparison on our channel of Red Matter 2. They were using a modified version of Unreal Engine to produce that game, right, Heaney?
Yeah, that was their own branch of UE4. We should note that when we're talking about Unreal Engine 5's Nanite and Lumen features, this is only applicable to PC VR and PlayStation VR 2. This doesn't work on Android. It doesn't work on mobile chips. By this, I'm talking about Nanite and Lumen. So developers on using UE5 for Quest games are going to have to use the older tech. And as Ian mentioned, you really can't have very many dynamic light sources at all on Quest. One or two, like in this studio, for example, we only light the avatars dynamically. Everything else is pre-baked. So this is going to be a really interesting kind of showcase of what is possible on those higher fidelity systems, PC VR and PlayStation VR 2. And that's where I expect we'll see most games, or at least most of the kind of flagship style games, leverage Unreal Engine, be it 4 or 5, as we already do. But on Quest, I would continue to expect to see Unity be the main engine chosen, partially because of its kind of focus on lower-end platforms and because Meta seems to prioritize it when it comes to features and support over Unreal Engine because they use it for most of their apps. They use Unity.
Yeah, I'm seeing Andrew Tech in our comments echoing exactly what you just said, Heaney. And I'm seeing a lot of really interesting questions and comments here. One commenter, let's see, Cake asking, when are YouTubers who review PC hardware going to start including VR games in their benchmarks? And then Opsar replying, VR is dead YouTube-wise, so they won't. You know, I think that may be a slight oversimplification, but it is kind of the issue that faces, right? The PC VR gaming audience is going to be such a small segment of their audience of PC gamers that it's not going to make sense to benchmark those things. And it's a whole nother process of difficulty to get the render resolution right and have that try to be representative of PC performance. It's a whole thing that's going to be very hard to do. I also liked Wayne's question with a question from Ireland asking you, just a personal question on you, Heaney. You're very informative and interesting to listen to. What's your background?
That's a very wide question. I think I'll have to leave that for another time. But I do find, what was the question before that? Sorry, the one you brought up?
They were talking about benchmarking yeah. PC VR games.
So I think you've two issues there. One is the sheer complexity of doing it, putting on a headset, having to make sure that you have all your VR settings correct. The second is that we've talked about on the show a lot, that there really hasn't been a major flagship blockbuster VR game since Half-Life Alyx. I would say we'll see YouTubers start to benchmark PC VR games when there are big PC VR games, whether that be like what's expected on PlayStation 5, where existing games get VR support, the hybrid models they call it, or be it games on the scale of Half-Life Alyx coming out. But as we've also discussed in this show a lot, the PC VR adoption has been effectively stagnating relative to PC VR, relative to PC gaming in general over the past 2 years. So VR developers aren't incentivized yet to actually build those sort of blockbuster games, or should I say regular game developers. why would a YouTuber want to benchmark a game that their fans don't care about? Hopefully, though, you know, we'd love to be able to do that sort of thing one day if we can grow to the scale where it was financially viable for us to have a bunch of different graphics cards and swap them out, and time viable. Hopefully, one of the other outlets starts to do it when big games come out next year, the year after, that were originally developed for PlayStation VR 2, but also make it to Steam VR.
Yeah, a wonderful overview there. I will, let's get to that question from Heaney another time, but I don't think I shared this bit that I learned about Heaney. Heaney and I'm going to answer a personal detail about Heaney that I learned when we met for the first time about a month ago or so at the SIGGRAPH Computer Graphics Conference in Vancouver. I told everyone I would eke out details about him. I discovered he only buys OLED smartphones because of the battery power and the contrast of the OLED. But he leaves his background blank on the phone because the pixels are off and it doesn't distract him. I like that little bit of detail about Heaney that I just share there. If he's not going to reveal his personal detail, I'll give you guys that to go off of. Are we ready to move on to the next subject, Heaney? Or did you see any comments there that we should respond to?
I just want to highlight Andrew Tech's comment. He's pointed out that Nanite and Lumen require deferred rendering, and standalone VR requires forward rendering. So that's one of the many reasons that it's not available. And that is a great point. You can't really do that high-end deferred rendering on mobile chips. And I expect that we'll see this sort of thing diverge over time, where developing a game for PC VR or PlayStation VR is going to be a very different set of technical requirements than developing a game for what is essentially a smartphone chip. And as I always say on this show, it is remarkable that developers are able to ship any VR games on standalone headsets that have these mobile phone chips in them. And something like Red Matter, that uses their own custom branch of UE4, is a technical marvel. And these are some of the most talented optimization engineers in the world that are working on mobile VR.
Yeah, wonderful overview there. And there really needs to be credit where it's due to the work to get this stuff running on mobile hardware. So let's talk about this next subject here. Quest has gotten some new in-VR recording options. This has been a long time coming. Content creators out there and just everyday folks with their Quest headsets have been asking for this, because it's been ugly to try to get content out of your Quest headset and out to the users out there. Basically, you've got four key options that have been added. You go into the experimental settings of Quest menu in V44, which is the latest version, and there is a toggle to turn these features on. And then you've got this new menu under camera that lets you go and add image stabilization, change the aspect ratio, change the frame rate, and change the video compression quality. I was running the public test channel version of V44, so it's possible that the settings changed between the version that was on my headset and the version that's publicly live. But assuming they're the same, I'm going to go through what I found in some of these options. All of these options have major trade-offs. So image stabilization, you can change that to low, medium, or high. But what changes is the field of view of your view can be compressed and smaller in the recorded video footage depending on how much you turn this up. But obviously, a stable video is going to be a major, major win for any footage you put out of a headset. Aspect ratio, I thought this one was really interesting because they have 1920 by 1080, that's 16 by 9 recording, which is going to be a big improvement for some people over the square video. But they have it in both portrait and landscape, which I think is a really interesting addition, because portrait obviously is going to work really well on mobile phones. And if they frame that right, it could be really interesting to catch all of your hand movements on mobile phones. I wondered if we'll see vertical videos on platforms like Reels or TikTok, and the weird things people do in VR with that aspect ratio could really be an interesting thing. Down at frame rate, this is the thing Heaney and I were talking about right before we came in here. I only saw options for, I think, 24 and 36 in my menu. I did not see anything beyond that. So that was one of the settings I was wondering if changed between the build that was on my Quest and the public one. So if anybody has a Quest 2 out there with V44, let me know what frame rate options you're seeing in there, because that's actually the really big one. If there's any developers out there who use Oculus Developer Hub, the Oculus Developer Hub has a bunch of options that developers can activate to record even at, I think, 4K resolution. And then there's 60 frames per second recording options in there. But there's even more trade-offs if you're a developer activating those features using a PC. As Heaney explained it to me at first, and then I tried it myself, it actually vignettes your whole view and provides you a rectangular viewport in VR. So it's a terrible experience inside the headset, but it actually produces really, really great footage. If you're a developer wanting to produce something like a trailer for your game, it makes a lot of sense to go and do that. But for users at home, I don't know if that performance trade-off really makes sense. We'll have to find out if there's a 60 frames per second recording option for users or not. And then obviously video compression quality, you can change the bit rate of how many bits per second are actually being recorded. And the file size is the big trade-off there. With frame rate, it's your app performance that could suffer. And that's the interesting one for users at home, where I'm actually kind of surprised Meta would even make that available to consumers at home, because they are so protective of users and their experience. But this is an experimental setting. I guess they're maybe becoming a little bit more comfortable with letting people do that. Anything else you want to add there, Heaney?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I guess that in VR performance, they have to balance against the kind of marketing benefit they get from people putting out footage that looks smoother. But to me, as we've pointed out in this show before, when we talk about the idea of recording options in VR, the biggest trade-off and the biggest consideration to talk about is this aspect ratio. And I have a little diagram here to show you what I mean. So normally when you're recording in a Quest or any sort of mainstream VR system, you get this square output, the blue rectangle here. And a lot of people obviously, their first ask for recording is to get widescreen. But on a standalone VR system, when you record in widescreen, you're not actually widening out the recording. You're just getting a lossless crop of that same square field of view. So this means that in melee games like Gorn or in cockpit games, you miss out a lot of the detail. In Gorn, you're going to miss out the top of your enemy and the bottom of your weapon. In a cockpit game, people aren't going to be able to see the part of your cockpit here when they're playing. So yes, you get a widescreen view that looks better on TVs and looks better on laptops. But personally, I prefer the original square aspect ratio, because you get the most visual information. You can see the full frame of what someone's seeing in VR, which to me is just more immersive.
Yeah, but the interesting thing that I thought about the portrait is you take the red one and rotate it vertically. You just cut off a little bit from the sides, and now you've got everything vertically from top to bottom. And if you're viewing that on a mobile device, that would be actually a really nice way to view what it looks like in VR, if that's how that works. I'm seeing a question. I wonder when Microsoft will get behind the VR gaming push. I'm guessing it's not their priority until they make Game Pass the Netflix of gaming. They are kind of one of the elephants in the room on PC gaming, and there's several of them, right? There's Epic, Valve, Microsoft, and Meta used to be in there, but they haven't really done anything. They've moved out of PC VR gaming. When do you think we're going to see anything happen significantly in PC VR gaming?
Well, I'd like to kind of flip your interpretation of the question away there and say that I think Microsoft's entry to VR won't be through the PC at all. It would be through the Xbox. It makes more, you know, that's the gaming brand they have. They have this, you know, console that they're selling in the same way that Sony's selling the PlayStation 5 that would be capable of rendering VR, that has, you know, a user base of dozens of millions of gamers, that doesn't have the fragmentation issues of PC and doesn't have the kind of hardware technical support issues of PC that Facebook found a nightmare, and even to a lesser extent HTC found a nightmare to deal with. What we heard in the past from, I can't remember which Microsoft executive, but they kind of hinted that they were waiting for wireless. And that, to me, seems like a could be potentially what happens, that eventually, if PlayStation VR 2 is successful, Microsoft may decide to launch a competitor for the Xbox Series X, at least, maybe even the Series S, where their unique perspective is to make it wireless, even if perhaps the core specs were a bit lower. Whether that also came to PC, it doesn't seem as likely to me. It seems like on the PC, Microsoft's consumer push is still not really in gaming fully. Yes, you have Game Pass, and yes, you have this Xbox app, but it's the offering there is kind of integrated with streaming in that they want to make this something that's possible for PCs all the way from basic laptops to high performance PCs. Whereas on Xbox, you have this single target of a high performance GPU ready to go.
Yeah, that's a wonderful framing. And I think Xbox is the center of their universe makes a lot of sense. The only thing I'd add, I guess, is the whole idea that when you get a Quest 2 right now, you get a dev kit when you buy that Quest 2, right? You don't have to go and get permission for a separate piece of hardware to develop. And I wonder, with Microsoft having something like Minecraft and all of its things that you can add on to it, and the rise of things like Roblox, where they have this really bustling creator ecosystem, I do wonder whether there's benefits to sort of Microsoft turning every Xbox into a dev kit, opening it up so people can publish and make a game on an Xbox and publish straight from that Xbox using some kind of tool set. But it's obviously, that's not going to be the same type of game as the games that they try to get on Xbox Game Pass, but it would make sense as an evolution to kind of open up Xbox a little bit more than it has been historically.
Yeah, I wonder how all this relates to the reports that we saw about earlier this year, claiming that Microsoft was still in this VR AR identity crisis about A, whether it wanted to be a hardware provider or just a software and system services provider, and B, about whether it wanted to target consumers or enterprise. If Microsoft's still stuck in that consumer versus enterprise debate, then they're not going to know whether they want to be in gaming, because that's very much so a consumer thing in VR. And if they don't know whether they want to be a hardware or a software provider in VR AR, then they're not going to know whether they want to launch an Xbox headset. So we could just be in that kind of messy transition period with, you know, post-Kitman, where Microsoft has to kind of realign its VR AR strategy before it knows what it wants to do.
I'm seeing Danny ask this question. Can anyone film stuff like this with their Quest 2? Yeah, for people who might not know, we have a build of this studio that runs on PC just for the OBS recording process. We've talked about that a little bit, Heaney, like what would it take or how would that process work? Is it completely unimaginable to have an external camera on standalone hardware?
Yeah, I think it's pretty difficult, to say the least, from a performance perspective, to be able to stream a virtualized, what is basically a third eye at full resolution while also handling the rest would be very difficult, to say the least. But I'd say anyone can do what we're doing here in VR chat. If you have your own custom setup in VR chat, you wouldn't have hand tracking is the only issue. It'd be limited to controllers, but there are other shows that use VR chat to achieve something similar to what we have here. The benefits of the way we do it is just it's very low friction for us, so we don't have to have any kind of extra complexity. We can jump into this studio in, 10 seconds and be ready to go and have our chat right in front of us on the tablet in front of me, the images that we have ready to cast up, our notes. But the basic concept is not something that only we have figured out.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot more VR studios sort of popping up there, and they're producing things in VR chat. But I do love the friction. Very early on in the development of this, if you go find our original VR download episodes, I was using like a Valve Index to come into the studio, and that was, I was begging Heaney for it, because the Valve Index has an incredible microphone and speaker system. And then you've also got the Index controllers, which have some level of finger tracking in them. Not this quality at this point. But every week I would join, there would be a new microphone problem. The system, some kind of handoff would go wrong between the microphone and the app. The speaker system would get confused, and it was just an absolute nightmare. So it was a huge benefit time-wise, and just the time sync to just be able to put on the headset with some trust that all the hardware is going to work together.
Yeah, in fairness, though, that was before Valve added their auto-switching to Steam VR, one of my favorite features that came to Steam VR, and we did report on it, but it obviously wasn't a blockbuster feature, is changing automatically to the correct output and input audio device. If you've only just gotten VR in the past few years, you won't even know how nice that is. It's one of those things that just works in the background for you, but anyone who's been around for more than a few years will know just how much of a nightmare getting the right audio devices on PC used to be.
So we already talked about the big story that I think, well, I guess these two last stories are pretty big and probably going to take up a pretty big discussion here. Are we ready to talk about Pico now, though?
Yeah, let's talk about Pico.
So Pico has an announcement coming up Thursday. They've been teasing things for quite a while. What are our expectations for this specific announcement, Heaney?
Yeah, so Pico 4, they haven't, ByteDance has not actually said the words Pico 4 yet, as far as I know. We haven't heard that said from ByteDance, but we pretty much all know that what they're talking about with this new product announcement is Pico 4. When they announced the current Pico Neo 3 that is available in Europe to consumers, they said then that anyone who bought it would get a 35% discount should there be another product from Pico within the next 12 months. So that was a big hint that there was a successor coming. Then in July, there was a US regulatory filing that revealed a Pico 4 and Pico 4 Pro, followed by images of the controllers leaking out. And then earlier this month, there was a Bluetooth standards body listing that revealed some of the specs, such as color pass-through, higher resolution, and the Pro model having automatic lens separation adjustment guided by the eye tracking. So we know that this is, we know the basic specs of this product. The regulatory filing showed an image that almost certainly showed pancake lenses, which support smaller displays that are closer to the lenses, and thus we would expect a slimmer and lighter design. So to put all the speculation together, what we're expecting on Thursday is for ByteDance, the company behind TikTok and Pico, to announce a Quest 2 competitor that is slimmer, lighter, and potentially has higher resolution and color pass-through.
Yeah, very big moment for VR to see a standalone competitor. I have tried Pico over the years, and I've been frankly underwhelmed by previous iterations of Pico hardware. Going back, you know, I remember seeing one, I think it was at like an E3 conference where they had, I think it was a gamepad wired into a headset, might have been wireless, but the headset was more or less taking information from something inside of a gamepad, might have even been the compute inside the gamepad. But they've looked for ways to differentiate from Meta in various ways over the years. That has been the interesting kind of theme in their successive hardware generations. They in one of their generations, they had, I think, the magnetic tracking that was really, really cool, where you could take your controllers and put them behind your back and they would still be accurately represented in your headset because they're using this magnetic tracking. But as Heaney and I have talked about, and he summarized so well, is magnetic tracking comes at the cost of things like heat, right? I think it produces a lot of heat.
It's the weight and the bulk and the cost. And, you know, as cool as it is to put the controllers behind your back, the vast majority of people will never even notice or care.
But so what I'm getting at here is they've looked for ways to differentiate their product from Meta in various ways, or from Facebook back in when it was called that, while competing with this just powerhouse machine that Zuckerberg has built, pouring money into the Quest platform. So exclusive after exclusive after exclusive, software updates that roll out on a monthly basis, if not quicker, because of the way that they roll out some experimental features. It almost makes it seem bi-weekly or more than monthly. And then if you're competing against that whole package, right, all these exclusive content, software that's constantly getting better at a very fast pace, and then you're attracting all the top games and building this great ecosystem, Pico has had a hard time keeping up, and they've moved into the East where they're based and not really brought their stuff to the West anymore. That is what we are looking for to see what Pico does with this moment, right? We're going to try to see how big their push is into the West and what markets they're going to compete in with Meta again, right?
Yeah, it is interesting that a lot of people sometimes describe Pico as being a knockoff of what Facebook or Oculus or Meta were doing. But Pico actually came out with the first standalone headset. They had a standalone headset that was essentially an Oculus Go a full year before the Oculus Go. And you can debate about whether they had kind of knowledge of what Facebook was doing based on being so close to the actual manufacturer of the Oculus headsets and being able to gain some of that knowledge. But it is clear that Pico is doing its own thing. It has its own technology base here. And as you say, those early attempts to be in the Western consumer market were very quickly pivoted back to Asia. And for the past few years, Pico had only really been selling to businesses in the West. Obviously, this year that changed with the launch in Europe. And one of our commenters here is asking, you know, do we expect this Pico 4 to launch in the US? And I think that is the huge, huge question because nobody knows the answer to that. A Chinese analyst has reported that this will be a global launch, but we don't know what he meant by global. He's claimed that there will be an aggressive subsidy to answer another commenter's question here about will this be closer to the Quest 2 price or the Quest Pro price. There's a claim here that ByteDance will put an aggressive subsidy in to take on Quest 2. And that still remains the biggest open question here. How will this thing be priced? Because if this can deliver a slimmer and lighter, higher resolution headset than Quest 2, at even $50 or $100 more, that is serious, serious competition to Meta for the first time. And even if they deliver a headset that doesn't have all the games, if they have the vast majority of the games, that's going to sway a lot of consumers.
Yeah, I think we see the commentary out there again and again. It was even, I saw it in the chat room before we came in here, you know, are we biased? And if you go back to the history, right, I have plenty of tweets in my timeline just absolutely destroying Oculus Go. I was excited about it before it launched, and then I lived with it for a while, and I just became absolutely very disappointed with this experience, where it had so many so many roadblocks there to comfort, right? You can't lean around in it. And it grates time and time again. And that was at the very outset of what Pico was doing. That was the competition, right? They were doing the same thing with an even less funded content library, right? And here we are today where this is a very serious moment in the evolution of VR, where we've got, you know, Meta has had several years here where they have been kind of in a market by themselves. It's one of the things that is recorded in the history of our site, where we've talked about Meta just 3 or so years where they're just uncontested in the standalone VR market with this wonderful feature set that everyone wants: hand controllers, six DOF movement, setup within the headset. And then these great games that really get you up and moving around in really satisfying ways. Pico is here. It's got these games that I am absolutely crazy about. Walkabout 11, Superhot has been on every system since 2016. Puzzling Places is amazingly satisfying puzzling experience. These are great, great experiences to have on a competing headset for the first time. We can't wait to see how this competition develops. And then we've also got PSVR, but we've talked again and again. We'll get into it again at the end of the show, but how it competes in a different way with all this stuff.
Yeah, it really is. As long as there's no crazy design flaw or this thing doesn't come out at a ridiculously high price, this really does seem like one of the most historical moments in the history of VR, where, as you say, this effective monopoly that Meta has built up will finally be challenged. And what a company to do it than their greatest competitor outside VR, the same company behind TikTok, obviously, with all the kind of ethical and privacy concerns you have there. Do you pick, you know, a company like Meta or a company like ByteDance? It's not, for people who are ethically concerned, it's not exactly the best choice between them. To answer a few of our commenters' questions here, Yul Zurl asks, do we think Meta will ensure Quest 3 has pancake lenses? Surely it will feel antiquated if it releases a year after with Fresnel lenses. I think we would definitely expect Quest 3 to use pancake lenses. I think with the exception of PlayStation VR 2, which isn't optimized at all for portability, so they can have this much bulkier design that balances out the weight through bulk and, you know, rather than sleekness, I think all of the mass market consumer headsets going forward will use Fresnel lenses, and even a lot of the niche, or will use pancake lenses, sorry, and even a lot of the niche headsets, because it just gets rid of this huge barrier to adoption of VR that some people have, that I don't, which is completely valid, that I don't want to put a giant brick on my face. Having something that is much more like a sleek visor than a brick is key to making VR a technology that many more people want to adopt. And it would be crazy for Quest 3 to not have it. Another commenter asks, based on these specs, won't Pico 4 be much closer to Quest Pro, which has been described as significantly more expensive than $800? I think it's important to note that the base Pico 4, according to the filing we noted, will not have face tracking, will not have eye tracking, and based on the leaked images of the controllers will not be self-tracking. There's also no indication that it will have a depth sensor for advanced hand tracking and advanced mixed reality, presumably. So it looks like Pico 4 will slot somewhere between Quest 2 and Quest Pro rather than being much closer. I would expect a price that is closer to Quest 2 than Quest Pro.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we've talked about again and again in our show. And thank you so much to Wayne talking about our back and forth here. Yeah, Heaney and I come from very different positions thinking about the way personal computing is developing. Heaney has got a perspective that is incredible, and it's amazing to be able to get him into the studio sharing his knowledge on a weekly basis. But we are obviously not the same person. We come from very different places, and I appreciate that you like that back and forth. Yeah, and we have a lot of people tuning in today. Thank you all. Please do hit that like button and share out this link to others so that we can get more people into this. And of course, please also think about becoming a member. Thank you to all of our subscribers and members who have been tuning with us on this journey. We absolutely cannot wait for the next steps of this. Heaney, what is your, development-wise, I saw someone asking, what did Pico pay developers to get their stuff onto Pico from Quest? And we don't know that. They haven't said, but we know that they've been purchasing, or they've been hiring a lot of people to spearhead that process. But I'm wondering, technically speaking, it's one of the things I've been harping on, and you always push back at me on, what's going to take to get this studio running on Pico in the next period of time? What is the process? Have you already laid the groundwork for that? Can you lay that out for our viewers out there?
Yeah, so VR development years ago used to be very much so device specific, where you had to use all these sort of vendor specific SDKs, and then if you wanted to port to a new headset, you'd have to go to an entire different SDK. These days with OpenXR, it is a lot easier. There's also big improvements in the engines, Unity and Unreal, where a lot of the code has been brought in to abstracted engine code that handles the low-level stuff so that you don't have to do it specifically for each platform. So there's the main work involved in porting to a new platform these days is just things like, it's the actual store process. It's the things like passing the store team's approval, uploading the assets, going through any of their compliance methods, making sure that you kind of authenticate the user based on their account for each system. It's not really like the core down in the deeps rendering or tracking or controller systems anymore. So that's mainly the kind of barrier there. These developers, I don't expect, were paid a significant amount. Maybe they were paid a small amount. But the appeal here is for the developers. They get a new market of users to buy their content. If you've built a game that is specifically for VR and doesn't run on non-VR consoles or PC, you're going to want to sell to as many people as possible, because the VR is already a lot smaller than the traditional platforms. So then you get all of the people who own Pico 3 by porting already, like these games have, and they obviously, these developers stay in tune with the industry. They had an inkling that Pico was going to release a Pico 4 in the next 12 months, just like we've talked about. And so then they know that by having these games on the store, they're ready for that entire new wave of users. So I don't expect there would have to be a direct financial incentive there.
Yeah, there was one other thing that I thought about just adding about the sort of ethical considerations, right, that are going to play into some of the debate, right, that's going to pop up as these things roll out to the market more. There is still the PC VR option for people out there. It just costs an arm and a leg, and it makes it hard for a lot of people to justify doing all that. But yeah, games like Walkabout, 11 Table Tennis, I think after the fall, have cross-play between platforms. And so you can come not just from these standalone systems that you might ethically disagree with on various levels. You can also get a system that, you know, you can mess up pretty badly if you want to because of its level of openness, and you can also have an experience and connect to these people. And that's the moment we are excited for, right? Where people on these multiple headsets can get into a lobby together and play a game. And it's something we've heard from developers like Jesse Schell at Schell Games, the creator of I Expect You to Die and Until You Fall. He has talked about this idea, and I think it's also been echoed by Zuckerberg himself, that when we cross a certain number of users in VR, and I saw it in our comments too, talking about retention, and retention being one of the things that worries people about VR always being small, where if you get enough of these headsets out into the market, there's a good chance there's somebody in your social circle that you can call up at any time and say, hey, do you want to go do this right now? So we've got very small numbers right now of people who are like 600 miles away from their brother. And back when they were kids, they used to play table tennis together or they used to go mini golfing. And now they've both purchased $400 Quest 2s and they're both jumping into VR to play together and having enormous fun. But it is a rare and unusual thing to happen right now. But when you've got multiple standalone platforms plus PC VR plus the potential that PSVR headsets can also connect, you start talking about potentially tens of millions of people in the next few years actually all having a headset at the ready to go and get into VR. So it's a whole new phase opening up where all these people can actually finally get into VR with somebody. I remember being in the Gear VR days and I knew someone else with a Gear VR, and it was just, there was stuttering on the headset when you tried to get into a movie with somebody else. And it was a miserable experience, even if you had these two really specific phones and headsets to meet up with. It's just a whole nother level of accessibility in order to get people into VR.
I've actually been shocked over the past 2 years how many people have got a Quest 2 that I never would have expected to have. You know, people who are kind of acquaintances or family members that say, oh yeah, I actually got one of those, that are the kind of person that maybe would buy a Switch Lite or a Switch and play some games on that. So to go to this next era that then, you know, anyone with a PlayStation 5 might want to jump in to, that you can get, you know, very soon something like a Quest 2 that's a lot slimmer and lighter and more appealing to people. It's going to be really fascinating to see just how wide this gets. And if you're like us and you've been in this industry for, you know, almost like 10 years now, it is astonishing to see what went from a hobbyist hacker industry that people said would always be a hobbyist hacker industry to turn into a viable, real mainstream consumer market where today there's, you know, north of 10 million consumer headsets out there. It'll be astonishing to see what happens when we get to 20 million, 50 million and beyond 100 million. It's a really, really exciting time to watch this industry finally evolve.
Yeah, I'm seeing people in our comments talk about these things that, you know, yes, user retention really is a problem, and it is clunky. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing it. Even as a VR enthusiast, I sometimes struggle to pick up my VR headset from time to time. We are there with you. It happens. There are periods that, you know, it just, if you know, so Half-Life 2 VR came out just a few days ago. There's a mod you can get for Half-Life 2 if you've got it on Steam. You just add this mod and now you can play the whole thing in VR, right? I want to get some video footage of this game up on our site. And I went into the first level and made myself sick within just a few minutes. One of the first levels there, you're on this rotating platform, and it was like it was ready-made to make me not feel great inside the headset. That's another thing, right? In addition to just if you're doing a multiplayer experience, then you've got to deal with, I don't know, room codes. You've got to deal with power being out on a headset. The list goes on and on of just how difficult it is. But those things are improving month by month by month. You know, these aren't unsolved. You know, these aren't problems people just walked away from. It's getting better and better and better as time goes on. And people that don't respect that it is getting better are kind of missing the forest through the trees.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to see that a lot of the current barriers that cause this friction, that cause this resistance, are being kind of chopped off one by one. I think the most interesting statistic on this, though, is that Rec Room, I think was about 6 months ago, revealed that they have 3 million monthly active VR users. So that's already a very interesting statistic that I think would go against some of the more pessimistic people's expectation. I don't think any of them would expect that you're having, in one app alone, 3 million monthly active VR users, where they said most of those requests too. But we'll need things like a headset that you want to put on because it's slimmer and lighter and it's more comfortable, that has color pass through with high resolution, so that you, when you want to go back to the real world, you don't have to take it off. You can just keep using the real world by double tapping or pressing a button underneath to go into pass through mode. To have headsets that better integrate your calls and your texts. You know, we have kind of messenger support and calling on Quest today, but there's a lot further that could go. And, you know, Apple has a lot of opportunity to make that more convenient. Multitasking, so that if you're in a VR game and you need to look up something in a browser, or, you know, you need to even just access some kind of browser app, be it Slack or whatever, you can just bring up the menu and bring up that browser while you're still in that game paused, rather than having to close the whole thing down. All of these features that will come year by year to these headsets are going to make that retention get better and better.
Are we ready to move on to our last planned subject for today? Yeah, leave any comments before we do that with good questions. We will try to get to them if we don't respond to them immediately. But we love the discussion, and we thank you all for being so supportive of one another with good questions and good advice.
Yeah, I'll just take two of the questions here. So someone was asking a lot further back what the other disadvantages of pancake lenses are, other than low optical efficiency. Well, the low optical efficiency is the main one, and it means that you have to drive the display brighter to get the same output brightness behind the lens that you would with a Fresnel lens. So that means on a standalone headset, they have to use brighter panels that take more energy and more heat. And the more energy part means that they have to use a bigger battery. So the cost of the lens is slightly bigger itself, but then you also have to back that up with a bigger battery, and you have to engineer the system. Another comment from Funky Sloth said, this Chromebook for the face market is a load of guff. We'll have to see whether that's true or not. I think there's a lot of potential in devices that give you triple or quadruple or six monitors, regardless of where you are. So you basically have an entire workstation set up on the go. A lot of people said that the VR gaming market was a load of guff 10 years ago, even 4 years ago. So we'll have to see how the technology pans out.
Yeah, I've tried. It's one of those things where you try it again and again and again, and it doesn't work, and it doesn't work, and it doesn't work, and then all of a sudden it does, right? It's good enough. They've put all the pieces in place. And I've done the thing where I've taken my Quest 2 in a bag and tried to use it on a plane and tried to imagine, you know, let's write a story while I'm on this 2-hour flight, and it's a big no. But we, you know, with a slimmer device, with more power there for multitasking, we can probably get there, I think. And there are some serious advantages to being able to know that you can focus, right? And there's no distractions for the time that you put your device on your head. Well, let's move on to this last subject here. That is the confirmation by Sony that original PSVR games are not going to be playable on PSVR 2. We've alluded to this for a long time on our show here. It seemed inevitable. And now, just a couple of days after you tried out this device, you know, Sony has gone out there and confirmed this very unfortunate aspect of its rollout. Heaney, what is the reasoning for this for our viewers out there?
So the official wording here was rather odd. It didn't really specifically say what the problem is. It said, this was Sony's official statement, PSVR games are not compatible with PSVR 2 because PSVR 2 is designed to deliver a truly next-generation VR experience. PSVR 2 has much more advanced features like all new controller with haptic feedback and adaptive triggers, inside-out tracking, eye tracking, 3D audio is coming together, and 4K HDR, of course. So this means developing games for PSVR 2 requires a whole new approach than the original PSVR. I think that's slightly exaggerating just how different these systems are. If you look on PC VR, there are games that were designed for very different hardware years ago that will still work on the latest hardware. But the real issue here is that Sony is trying to deliver a console level experience where everything works, and the button mapping that you see in front of you, the controls that the game instructs you in the tutorial, are accurate to the controller you have in your hand. And PlayStation VR 1 games, many of them were meant to work with the DualShock gamepad, which you held in two hands and had a very different kind of button layout and feeling than having two separate hand controllers. The ones that were using hand controllers obviously used this PlayStation Move, which didn't have thumbsticks, didn't have a grip trigger, and had four buttons and a very different layout than this. So these games are not going to just be instantly playable. Theoretically, what Sony could have done is add support for the PlayStation Move controller to PlayStation VR 2. Those inside-out tracking cameras could theoretically fairly easily track this colored ball. Maybe the tracking quality wouldn't be excellent, but that still
wouldn't be the positions would be different, right? The four cameras on the inside-out tracking might not get the Move controllers in the same positions that the outside-in camera can get, right?
It wouldn't matter because that's, you know, the first on PSVR 1, they're doing it relative to the headset based on seeing the headset. On PSVR 2, they're doing it relative to the headset by looking outwards from the headset. That wouldn't really be the issue. This could be tracked, but then Sony would have to invest, you know, time and resources into supporting an old controller. Where instead, what they probably want to do, and the upside of this story, is that I would suspect that plenty of PlayStation VR 1 games will be ported to PlayStation VR 2. Developers will release either updates or entirely new versions that utilize this controller and all of the new technologies that Sony talked about. The eye tracking that enables foveated rendering, the haptic feedback, the adaptive triggers, the better audio system, all of that technology will be utilized. The open question is, and this is what I imagine every PlayStation VR 1 owner wants to know, what is the actual store entitlement system going to be here? If you own a PlayStation VR 2, or if you own a PlayStation VR 1 version of a game and a developer comes along and releases a PlayStation VR 2 update, do you get that update for free or do you have to pay for it? Similarly, if a developer releases an entirely new enhanced edition for PlayStation VR 2, do you get a discount if you own it for PlayStation VR 1 or is it completely you have to buy it again? I'm not a huge console gamer personally, but I do know that Microsoft has generally been praised as handling this kind of cross-generational upgrade path better than Sony. Sony has been criticized for often, you know, requiring you to either repurchase or purchase a relatively expensive upgrade, whereas Microsoft in general seems to be offering it. So how will this translate to VR?
I'm seeing a couple of really interesting questions here. Annoyable asking, why did they put two PS buttons on the controllers, one on each? Games like Pistol Whip only require one controller, but I also wonder about the possibility, Heaney, that you can just turn on the PS5 and with that button and get in, you know, put on your headset and go into watch a movie or whatever you want without even messing with your TV interface at all. Do you think you could do that with just one controller on the system, or are you going to have to get both controllers out every time?
That's an interesting perspective. When I tried it, the system worked with one controller. It didn't force you to have two controllers connected to work. I was still able to use it. Whether you'd want to use it like that, that's an interesting question. I suspect they just did it for convenience so that when you tell someone press the PlayStation button, it's a lot easier and you don't have to think about which hand. I remember a lot of the time when I'm demoing VR, I demo VR to a lot of people. If you tell them to press the little menu button that's underneath the button, they're not sure which hand first. There's a little bit of confusion. A lot of the time they might press the system menu button rather than the game menu button. So maybe Sony's just trying to remove that complexity.
Yeah, but I do really like this idea that maybe we could use this as a way to get into PSVR really, really quickly. We'll see what happens there. And then there's this other question from Alyssa. Do you think PSVR will have social apps, things like big screen VR, walkabout, mini golf, etc., that will be cross-platform? I think, you know, there were things like Rec Room that hit that, you know, waited a couple of years to get on PSVR or get on PlayStation, and they have the same crossplay that you have on every other system. I think we're over that period of time where they're segmenting those audiences in really uncomfortable ways. So I do have every expectation there's going to be some really great stuff for social play on PSVR 2, don't you, Heaney?
Yeah, I think I can't imagine any VR developer that isn't on some sort of Meta exclusive contract not wanting to be on PlayStation VR 2. Obviously, there's a difficulty in that it's more difficult for developers to access development kits. As you mentioned earlier, Quest 2 is a development kit, just as when you get a Pico, it is a development kit, whereas with this, it's a lot more difficult. But I would say all of those applications you talked about there, I would be incredibly surprised if they don't make it onto this hardware.
And there was a question about whether PSVR 2 is going to work on PC. No, there is no, but I want it to, and I will dance around Heaney in this studio if it ever happens.
For any viewers who aren't aware, this is our biggest argument of all. Me and Ian disagree. Ian and I disagree on this more than we disagree on anything else. Where, you know, Ian believes it would be beneficial to Sony and or Valve, and I think it would not be in Sony's benefit whatsoever. So go and watch pretty much any episode on PlayStation VR 2 that we've done, and you can hear that same debate over and over again. And who knows, maybe in about a minute or two, we'll rehash it all over again.
Yeah, no, I wanted to respond to the commenter there and not take responsibility for arguing with Heaney this week on myself. What about on Apple products? We will be curious to see how Apple's platform rolls into kind of the social interconnected debate, right? Like, we've still got some time before we expect Apple to kind of push its development platform. We actually had one moment of debate previously of just how secretive Apple probably is with those dev kits, right? Like, are they actually sending them out to really trusted studios, or are they keeping those headsets within their own confines? And as I've always, in the past, I've heard that they've typically, in the weeks before a developer event or an announcement, they actually invite developers to their headquarters to try out unreleased hardware and develop on it and work sort of hand in hand with engineers in getting demos up and running on new hardware. I would expect that to be the way they go forward. So if there's any devs you follow out there on like Twitter or Facebook and they enter a black hole and don't start updating for months, those might be the devs that get invited to Apple headquarters and building for them. But we really don't know. There's still some time for Apple to come together there. And it would be a real disappointment if Apple kind of doesn't make its stuff compatible with all the other systems.
Well, I think there's two questions there. You know, will Apple make it easy and support developers of existing VR applications to come to their platform? And then the other question is, will Apple's first-party software come to other VR platforms? I think, you know, we've seen Apple's first-party Apple TV Plus software come to Google's Chromecast technology, for example. We've seen Apple bring Apple Music to Android in recent years. So the Apple of today is not the Apple of yesteryear, but I still do think it would be highly unlikely to see Apple, for example, put FaceTime onto Quest headsets or anything like that.
Yeah, it's so there's two things, and just this requires kind of an editorial to kind of hash out or get it out there. But there's two things out there that have been in recent memory where Apple rolled out these AirTags where you can track this little device that's about this big and get updates on it. And it uses a very clever Bluetooth system for tracking this location, no matter, you know, just through iPhones, right? They're communicating device to device, and you don't need kind of like a standard Wi-Fi or cellular connection in order to track this device. But I've used one of these devices and gotten messages from people who get this alert on their device that an AirTag is moving with them because it just so happened that, you know, that's the system that Apple has built on iPhones to alert people to the presence of these devices that could be used for nefarious purposes, for tracking people when they don't intend to be tracked. And on Android, very quietly, I didn't even know it for a long time, Apple rolled out a piece of software on Android, on Google Play, so that you can scan on an Android for these devices. But the fact is, you are less safe if you're using an Android because someone could slip one of these AirTags into a purse, into a backpack, and you wouldn't know that it was there tracking you unless you went and downloaded this app and manually scanned. The other thing that is in recent memory is Google has even gone on the offensive with an ad campaign complaining about the interoperability of text message platforms. So everyone knows the green bubbles that pop up if you text from an iPhone to an Android. There's also lower quality videos and photos that interplay. And then there's just the brutal, brutal situation where if you press on a message on an iPhone and hit like or give it a thumbs up, if you're on an Android, every one of those thumbs ups that gets added to that message by your group chat gets, you know, becomes a new message in your timeline. And so, like, if you have a group chat with 15 people and 15 people go and like it, you get 15 text messages when every person likes it. And it's miserable. I can't imagine how this next phase of personal computing is, you know, these things can't continue. I don't want to see these interoperability issues continue in the next generation of computing.
It's interesting that Google Pixel actually put into their messaging app a feature that would parse those messages. So as you say, they're sent as, you know, your name liked this message. Google actually parses that and shows them as a reaction now. So ironically, if you're on the iPhone side, you see all those messages. But if you're on the Android side, it's actually put together nicely. So Apple will, it's interesting to me that Apple will go so far to make sure that they keep this iMessage moat, that they won't that they will even ruin the user experience for their own users just to make it so that the people they're interacting with, their users will be annoyed by. And a very funny comment here from May of the Frost saying avatars on non-Apple headsets will show up as green.
And EOL making the comment that Tim Cook did address this recently. Someone put him on the spot to talk about this issue, and Tim Cook's comment was, I don't hear my customers asking for this fix, which is pretty fair, right? It's not, he's not selling to those Android buyers, but also the response, go buy your mom an iPhone, is not great. You know, it's kind of cold, I guess, in the grand scheme of things. Was his comments on the record on this subject. I just, There is this coming wave coming. We've talked about a few times, Heaney, where a couple years ago or a little while ago, Meta tried to roll out ads in VR. And there is this fundamental difference where Meta is approaching the market, where these devices will come between you and reality. They literally come between you and the physical world. And that gives the device enormous power over your perception, over your safety. And we were going to have to keep an eye on how these companies approach this next generation. And it's funny to think, like, is Apple going to block out ads in the physical world so you don't have to see them on future devices, on AR devices one day? And will Meta just reskin ads and put their own ads? Or will Apple do the same thing, right? Like, because it's all, at the end of the day, it always ends up being money that they have to keep growing and keep trying to bring in more money. But we are facing that very real situation where you could have situations or analogies, I think, about where you could be walking down the street and going into a store and your glasses can recognize where you are and basically set up an alternate shop for you at that moment, right? Show you, you're looking at a product here, pop up, oh, you can actually just order this delivered to your home for $2 less from a store down the street. You know, that is an end game for some of these thinkers. If the company that owns that experience on the most number of eyeballs will be the most profitable company in history, is kind of the thinking long-term over AR, isn't it, Heaney?
Yeah, it will be fascinating to see. You know, one of the recent changes at Apple, and as I was saying earlier, the Apple of today is not the Apple of 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 15 years ago, is that one of their biggest hiring areas is actually their own ads division. And they're starting to put ads into the App Store. They're starting to put some ads into their first party apps, things that you really wouldn't have expected from Apple, because you know, their other divisions are so profitable and they've made these businesses so large that their continued quest for growth is difficult without opening up an entirely new business sector. And ads is one of those fastest growing sectors. One of the things people don't realize is that Amazon's ad division actually makes them more profit than their shopping division, for example. So I've actually noticed that some of the big former ad executives at Facebook are now working on Apple's new ads project. And as a lot of people have pointed out, a lot of the kind of privacy campaigners, Apple is very funny about how it uses its own terminology. So with other companies, they talk about tracking you and profiling you. And with Apple, it's personalizing your advertising. So I wonder if we'll see the Apple AR glasses block out other people's ads, but then put Apple's own ad network on in front of it, but tell you that theirs is privacy protected.
Yeah, the branding and the framing of all these technologies ends up being a real battle, right? And that is a good note to just tell, you know, support our work. There aren't a ton of journalists covering the VR AR space. We could use your support, your help, become a member, support our work. And these departments at these mega corporations have dozens, if not hundreds of people working on shaping their message and trying to get across their way of viewing the world across to everyone. And we're pressing against that. We're pushing back where we can and trying to make sure that the clarity is there for our people who are going to be using this technology. I liked the one comment here talking about people just not being interested in AR. And yeah, that is, you know, technically speaking, Heaney, we keep going back to that, right? We're going to see VR headsets with AR features added on them. And those are going to be very useful indoors. And they're going to be additions, value adds to indoor use, at-home use. And I'm so in love with the idea that you can do more and more things at home. And then you go outside to kind of get away from your devices as we go into this next phase. I don't see myself. I've been wearing the camera glasses and they're cool, but it's such a long way to go before those are really, really appealing, right?
Yeah, I'm just kind of reading those same comments where a lot of our commenters saying that either, you know, they don't see AR as being a big thing in any foreseeable future. And some of the, you know, even I'm seeing someone say they hope it feels if it doesn't hurt VR too much. And a lot of people are unable to kind of visualize this yet because it is so far off. And we want to say that we don't disagree in any way. The AR glasses that Ian's talking about, the kind of speculative far future use cases for, are not technically possible anytime soon. The reports that we've seen suggest that these companies, you know, Meta and Apple, aren't going to come out with AR glasses until the second half of this decade, you know, 2026 and beyond. But the technology that's going into VR headsets that are getting AR features will kind of cross-pollinate, and it is in many ways setting the foundation for these AR glasses. And in the meantime, we also kind of do expect to see smart glasses that don't put virtual objects into your real world space, but do use the cameras to have some awareness of what's going on around you and give you contextualized notifications and guidance in a way that isn't practical by just holding up your phone screen. So obviously, we're going to be charting this market as it comes to life over the next sort of 3, 5, 10 years. But in the meantime, yeah, the focus for AR is very much so going to be on these opaque headsets that use cameras to reconstruct your real world. And with Quest Pro, with Pico 4, with Apple Reality, with Lynx R1, we're about to see that entire sector of devices come to life. A sector that really just does not exist today is going to come to life. And I'm really excited to see what developers build with that.
Yeah, there was a question here that I thought was really interesting. James making the comment, I've seen it on Twitter, where AR is the UI for AI. So it's a very interesting way of summarizing very big technologies that, AR is letting you interface with artificial intelligence. And I thought there was a really interesting question that might be a good way to leave off the show, just to ponder as we move forward. Is VR a gateway to AR, or is it the other way around? Yeah, I'll be thinking about that for a little bit here. And there was the talk of Pokemon Go. I do have like an editorial out there where Pokemon Go in my head is kind of a augmented reality pet, right, that walks around with you everywhere is a really, really interesting idea to me, more than these things of like virtual clothing that I'm seeing make the rounds right now. The idea that you could have a virtual pet following around with you and then potentially finding and interacting with strangers' virtual pets, and you've given your pet permission to interact with other pets, and they've given their pet permission to interact with yours. That's a really interesting idea, I think, very long-term. Pokemon, right? Catching Pokemon, playing that game in the mid-90s. I was an original Pokemon Blue owner on that Game Boy screen, and there's entire generations out there, millions upon millions of people. That one game alone is going to be a killer app and a major reason to use AR over the long term, in my opinion. Any last things we should talk about here before we sign off?
Yeah, I was just going to firstly agree with you that Pokemon Go seems like the ideal game for AR glasses. But it's important to note that the most people that play Pokemon Go today are not really playing an AR game. It's AR in the loosest sense of the term, in that you are using a kind of real world map. I would more call it just a geo game. But even when it comes to the encounters, the majority of people are still playing it with AR mode turned off. It's not really an AR game. But as you say, when you can go to the park and actually see Pokemon in your real world around you and have a Pokemon battle with your friend in front of you, that's going to be a completely different level of experience. And I would argue maybe more popular than the smartphone Pokemon Go app ever was, unless there's some sort of competitor that does the same thing. But to come back to that question you brought up first, which is the gateway to which? Is AR a gateway to VR, or is VR a gateway to the other? As I said many times in this show, I don't think it's either. I don't think one is a stepping stone to the other. I think these things are going to coexist in the same way that a smartphone isn't a gateway to a PC and a PC isn't a gateway to a smartphone. When you're at home, you're going to likely be using these powerful, opaque headsets that give you a wide field of view and a lot of computing power and let you be in a completely virtual environment or in a high fidelity mixed reality environment. And then when you walk out the door, you're going to set that headset down on its charging port and you're going to pick up your glasses and walk around the real world. And they're going to be a lot less powerful and not give you the same kind of fidelity, but they're going to let you interact with the real world and walk around and walk onto a bus without having to worry that it runs out of battery or turns off and leaves you in darkness.
Great subject to leave off on there. Thank you all for tuning in. We will be back on Tuesdays unless breaking news drops in our laps right as we're getting ready to broadcast, and then we'll delay it a little bit. But yeah, thank you all for tuning in. Thank you for our amazing conversation. Please consider becoming a member, supporting our work more directly. Let's get more people in here and really introduce more people to VR and all the things that people are doing that are really cool out there. We'll see you in the future, and thank you so much for tuning in.
Thanks again, and yeah, we really hope to see you here again next week.